I'd give for that wonderful phrase.
Patricia T. O'Connor is here, the author of a number of books on the English language, Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Origins of the Specious, and more recently a children's book, Woe Is I, Junior, and I'm sure there are a couple more in the works.
We'll see. I don't want to give anything away.
Meanwhile, you also have a website, gramophobia.com.
Yes. Yes, and I love hearing from WNYC listeners at the website and answering questions.
In a little while, we'll be taking listener calls at 212-433-9692, but you wanted to talk about something rather deadly?
Yeah, something light. And, of course, death is always good for a chuckle. So I thought I'd talk about death-defying euphemisms. I've been thinking about this lately because Not too long ago, I finished reading the letters of Jessica Mitford, author of The American Way of Death, and I greatly enjoyed her letters to funeral directors and the way they have all these death-defying means of denying that a death has taken place or that that's a corpse lying in the coffin and all those things. And so it brings up the idea of language, why we have so many euphemisms for language. For the language of death. In fact, a listener wrote to me to say that an NPR report on the death of the race car driver Dan Weldon last month used the verb passed rather than died. It said he passed. And the listener wondered if that was correct English, if that was correct usage.
Well, I've heard it used many times.
Yes.
Passed away and then passed.
Passed. Exactly. But it turns out those usages both came into vogue at about the same time in, believe it or not, the 14th century.
Mm.
It saying passed alone died out in Britain, but in North America, people still say passed instead of passed away. They just say passed.
Well, why do you think that is? Is it because we're uncomfortable saying he died?
I think so. I think that saying someone died or is dead or talking about death, it sounds very abrupt and final, and it's the kind of thing like sex or childbirth and all these other life-shattering experiences we like euphemizing, if that's a correct word.
I understand. It sounds softer. On the other hand, if I say somebody passed away, I'm still saying that person died, and it's understood to be the exact same thing, isn't it?
Of course, of course. But you know, it's not just people avoiding the truth. A lot of these things are poetic. For instance, Shakespeare's "This Mortal Coil." You know, when we talk about life as a mortal coil, that's from the line in Hamlet: "When we have shuffled off this mortal coil." And I always wondered why a coil, because
I always wondered about the shuffling.
Well, true.
I mean, buffalo, yes, mortal
right.
coil, I'm not so sure about.
Well, in Shakespeare's time, the coil meant something different than it does today. The meaning of a coil of rope or something lying in concentric circles, that meaning hadn't been developed yet in Shakespeare's day. In his time, coil meant confusion or turmoil, bustle, hustle, bustle, that kind of thing. And when he said, "When we have shuffled off this mortal coil," he meant when we have discarded the hustle and bustle and the turmoil of this mortal life. And now the same thing is true of bite the dust. We think of it as a slang expression. But in fact, it was known in Homer's time. In many of the battle scenes in the Iliad, he speaks of people who, well, it's been variously translated as bite the dust, bite the earth, bite the dust of earth. And whether it's accidental or not, that expression has revived in English in the late 1700s, to bite the dust.
It makes sense in the Iliad where
uh-huh,
there
would
be a sword fight.
You fall to the ground.
But
right.
Now it sounds kind of
I know.
Light. It bit the dust. One bit the dust.
True. In Homer's time, it was terribly dramatic and vivid, and you had this vision of mighty Hector falling to the ground and teeth going into the dust, you know. But now it's, you might say, my car, the transmission blew and it bit the dust. It's a jokey expression now.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and we'll be taking your calls in a few moments at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And I'm sure you have a few other examples, but we have listeners already calling in with their thoughts on this, so maybe we should include them in the conversation.
Good.
Bob from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Hi. There was one that I've come across, and it actually takes it up, the euphemism takes it up to be a little more grisly. It's the expression, you said bite the dust. Bought the farm?
Oh, yes, bought the farm. There are a couple of different theories about that one. That expression originated in the mid-20th century in the American military, and the OED suggests that it may have come from the notion that when an American military plane crashed onto a farmer's property and was damaged by the plane and, of course, killed the pilot, that the farmer would be paid restitution. And it was the deceased pilot, in other words, who supposedly buys or bought the farm. Now, there's another theory that makes a little more sense to me. I don't know if it's any more legitimate, but this theory is that the family of a soldier or sailor killed in action would be paid a death premium, and that with this premium would go back to the family, and they'd be able to pay off the family farm mortgage, so that when the kid takes a bullet, he bought the farm.
It still seems, like slightly insensitive, doesn't it?
Well, of course, but this is the military we're talking about.
I was around, but when skydiving was coming in, and it was used very, jokingly among skydivers.
It originated
that if your
with pilots.
Didn't open, literally scraped up the soil and had to take it and bury that.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling us. A listener points out that Joey Adams, had a whole bunch of euphemisms for death, including ended the line, went to his just reward, fell off the twig, sounds rather awful.
Yes, now that one actually, believe it or not, dates back to the 1500s, some versions of that.
Fell off the twig?
Well, this was to
like
hop.
A bird, I guess.
To hop or fall or drop off the perch. Mm-hmm. Dates back to the 1500s. They both allude to the fact that a dead bird falls off its perch. And then in the 1700s, another version of that came along, to hop the twig. To hop meant to depart, fly off. And the twig, of course, meaning the twig that the bird was sitting on. So if you hop the twig, you die. And that was actually used as a line in a play in the 1700s, if the old lady hops the twig, something like that.
A number of listeners called in to talk about that one. We have Barbara from Manhattan calling in about passing.
Yes, I was just trying to recall. I don't know the exact history. Maybe your guest does. But back in the 20th century, in the beginning of the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th, there was this resurgence or this creation of obsessions with talking to the dead after they died. If you recall, Houdini tried to get in touch with his mother after he. That was a big thing that he was doing, going to seance sessions. And these fakes who ran the sessions, and by the way, that continued on television until recently. There was a guy who was on television, who was always had audiences there, and they were trying to get in touch with their relatives who had died, And the term used by these seance fakes was passed over, and the reason was that they insisted that people who died did not really die. They passed over the border into another place.
Into another realm.
That dates back to the first time pass, or some version of passed, was used to mean to die, was the year 1230, the first recorded example. And the early examples were to pass to God, pass to heaven, pass over that sort of thing. Then pass away came about in the 14th century, as well as just pass all by itself. So those have been around for a very long time.
Thank you so much for calling us. David in West Hampson, Long Island, says that media outlets are typically a lot more comfortable saying someone had died when that person is unpopular, like Gaddafi.
Oh, that's interesting. You don't say Gaddafi passed away.
No.
Right. You're right. That's a good point. We're more likely to euphemize, if that's a word, I keep using it, when the thought of saying he died is painful somehow.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any others before we go to a break? And when we come back, by the way, we'll talk about other things as well, because we don't want to just focus on death, although it's one of my favorite subjects.
Kick the bucket is another.
Now, how did kick the bucket
theories.
Come?
Yeah. Bucket used to have two distinct meanings in English coming from different sources. One meant the pail. The other meant a beam from which things are suspended. And one theory about kick the bucket is that someone would stand on a bucket, put a noose around his neck, kick it away, and die. But I think the one that lexicographers or etymologists prefer is that the bucket, a word that came in from French, was a beam or a yoke from which animals were suspended by the heels when they were slaughtered. And they, in their death agonies, they would kick the beam, and that's how kick the bucket came about.
Well, it makes
pretty
more
grisly.
Sense than the other version, which would only apply to suicide.
Exactly.
Although this applies to...
Right.
I mean, it really makes more sense in an abattoir than anywhere else.
Yes.
So have we
but there
pretty
are
much
many
hit...
more.
Oh, give me a few more examples.
Oh, you want another one? Okay,
yeah.
To croak. This brings
croaking.
Us to the 19th century, to croak.
Well, but that's obvious, right?
Yeah,
People supposed to make that death croak?
Yes, that's exactly. It's thought to be a reference to the groaning of a person dying. And then, of course, pushing up the daisies, that's mid-19th century, a reference to the fact that you're underground and there are daisies growing above you. And handed in his dinner pail is... You used to find that a lot in early 20th century literature. Woodhouse, P.G. Woodhouse used it a lot. To hand in your dinner pail, it meant you weren't going to work anymore. And checked out from the 1920s. It's an extension of the earlier meaning to check out of a hotel. That's to depart, to leave, never to be seen again, to check out. So those are a few more.
And we're going to check out for just a moment. And then we'll come back with more of your calls and comments to Patricia T. O'Connor. Our number again, the new old number, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org.
Give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase. To hear those three little words.
Mel Torme brings to mind the fact that he was called the Velvet Fog. You have to wonder how some of these things were invented in the first place and why that one took off. I'm sure people had other ways of describing him.
You know, I've read his autobiography, but I can't remember if there was anything in there about it. It's been about 15 years ago.
A listener points out that from a translation of Gogol's The Overcoat, he gave up the ghost, but I've heard he gave up the ghost a lot.
Yes. That one, I don't know where it came from, but I'm sure that to give up the ghost means to have the soul released from the body, I would guess.
Okay, let's take some calls on all sorts of different language matters. And the first one is Bill from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was looking in the American Heritage Dictionary, and it says that from the standpoint of accent, the word formidable is accented on the first syllable, not, as a lot of people say, formidable. Mm-hmm. And similarly, revocable instead of revocable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, revocable, yes.
Revocable, like irrevocable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
But so it's formidable, not formidable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's mayoral, not mayoral.
I think both of those are in there, but
why do you think that people tend to
pronunciation is it's not so much a matter of correctness as it is of convention. In other words, if everyone started saying formidable, the dictionaries would eventually change their pronunciation guides. It's what happened with niche and niche. Niche used to be the preferred pronunciation. Niche came along only in the 1950s. But now, niche is ahead of niche.
Not for me, it isn't.
So that's the thing about pronunciation. You have to keep in mind that it's very fluid.
I also like a knish.
There's a good niche for a knish in your...
Thank you for calling us, Bill.
Apropos of your previous subject, would you say a soldier was mortally wounded or mortally injured?
Well, I would say mortally wounded unless he tripped over his backpack. And then he would be mortally injured.
Thank you for calling us. That's another one, mortal. But that's not a euphemism.
That's really
a better way of describing how a person died.
Right.
We have John from Manhattan via... London, is it?
Yep, that's right.
What does that mean? Where are you calling from, London or Manhattan?
Manhattan.
Go ahead.
No, I was just wondering if the Maven knew the slang, the Cockney rhyming slang for dead. He's brown bread.
Really?
He's brown bread.
Well, we say he's toast.
There's probably many Cockney slang expressions for, it's past, but...
I find rhyming slang hard to get the hang of.
Yeah, everybody knows a little bit of different. Nobody seems to know it all.
Right, right.
But I just reminded me, brown bread, and when I heard biting the dust, it just triggered that off when I was growing up. Anyway, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
So is brown bread, is that toast?
No, any kind of brown bread. He's brown bread. He's dead.
It's just a rhyme.
So it just rhymes with
just
dead.
Just rhyming slang.
I see.
Thank you for calling us. But we do say he's toast as well.
Right.
Which does not mean he's really
Thanks
dead, but he's...
to Bill Murray.
Yeah, but he's dead for all intents and purposes in his career or whatever.
Right, right, right.
Okay, let's go to Jack from... Where are you in New Jersey?
I'm in Rick, New Jersey.
Okay. Hi, Jack.
I'd like to mention the life-cheapening euphemism, taken out, which political figures are now so fond of using.
He's taken out. Oh, yes, yes.
Well, he was taken out of the parlor floor and down to the funeral home. That's terrible, Jack.
That's awful. You know, another one I didn't mention was ring down the curtain.
Yeah.
He's rung down the curtain. And do you know where that phrase comes from? Why they say ring down the curtain in the theater? It's because when curtains were raised or lowered originally in theater, the signal for the person to raise and lower was to ring a bell. So you rang down the curtain, rang up the curtain, etc.
Ah. Well.
That's why we say... See, I used
nowadays, to... Nowadays, you hardly ever see a curtain in a theater.
Yeah, right. Let alone hear a bell.
When I enter a theater and there is this big red curtain...
Uh-huh.
You preventing me from Congreve. Knowing what the set looks like. I like that.
It's Louise. A surprise when it opens.
Yes.
It's a jewel box.
Louise from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I have a question concerning pronunciation. I teach English as a second language, and my students will often ask me why we don't pronounce the B in doubt and debt,
mm-hmm.
and why we have various pronunciations or silence for the GH sound, like in rough and fought.
And then we could say K and knock.
Right. That's a very complicated question. And the short answer is that those letters at one time were pronounced, Mm-hmm. When the spellings were standardized, in the whenever printing came into Great Britain, 1300s perhaps, those letters may have actually been pronounced. For instance, knife, the K used to be pronounced knife, okay, almost like the CH in the word loch, almost as a Scottish sort of sound. Mm-hmm. And as far as laugh, the of all those GHs used to be a guttural sound that that was lost over the centuries, but the spelling stayed the same because the spelling was it was committed to writing, whereas pronunciation wasn't in the same way. Pronunciation was fluid.
But, you know, not just your students who come from other countries. George Bernard Shaw famously suggested, because he thought that the English language spelling should be simplified, that we spell fish, this was his joke, G-H-O-T-I.
Right.
Because the F was from laugh, G-H. Uh-huh. The O was from women. And the T-I was from any condition or whatever. So, fish.
Mm-hmm. He was a bit of a crank about standardized spellings. But you did mention debt and doubt.
Yes.
Those two, the B's were not. For instance, the B was pronounced in climb. It was climb. But the B's in debt and doubt were added by people who wanted. They originally were spelled D-E-T-T and D-O-U-T or D-O-U-T-E. And the B's were added by Latinists later who felt that they should reflect their Latin origins. Dubitare for doubt and the one for debt.
And those Latinists have really messed us up. That's why we can't do split infinitives and all sorts of other things.
I know. They introduced a lot of weirdnesses into English. It's really much more reasonable language than people think.
Ralph from Flushing, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, Ralph.
I called for one reason, but while listening to you folks, I had something to contribute on the Velvet Fog. To the best of my knowledge, that was coined by a disc jockey on a minor station in New York City called Freddie Robbins.
Hmm.
And I believe Fred Robbins called him that. Fred Robbins coined names for all the stars. He would refer to Benny Goodman as Rachel's dad and so on. Anyway, he came up with Velvet Fog, I think on the basis of the breathy tone that Torme.
Oh, no, it perfectly describes the sound of Mel Torme.
Yeah.
But what are you calling about?
Okay, I called to ask you two how you feel. And we've all faced changes in the language that bother us as time marches on and they really move into acceptability. But this one I've been hearing lately a great deal, and I can't think of any reason for it except trendiness. It's the use of the words of a in a phrase like, how big a deal?
Not that big of a deal.
I've heard Leonard say this.
No, you've never heard me say that. You have not heard me say that. And whenever people write it for me, I always cross out the of.
Sorry. Somebody on there.
Well, don't blame me.
Okay, I apologize.
As the song goes. Anyway, but do you have any idea why that is? Are we making too big of a deal of this?
We're making a big deal out of it. But there are parallels in other phrases, like it was a heck of a storm, or it was a whale of a good time.
Yeah. Well, we can't say it was a whale good time.
No.
We have to say of a.
No, right. You have to use it in those phrases. And it may be by analogy that it crept into not that big of a deal. I don't know. That's just a guess on my part. But people do make a very big deal out of it.
I grit my teeth every time I hear it.
Well, thank you for calling us. A listener, Rhoda, from the Upper West Side writes, a TV reporter referred to a police officer who was injured as a two-year veteran. How can you be a veteran with such little experience?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Right. People get into the habit of using veteran after a number of years, or after mentioning how many years someone's been doing something. And veteran is supposed to mean a long time, but saying a two-year veteran, it's hardly a veteran. It's more like a two-year rookie.
Well, that's just falling into some kind of a pattern, isn't it?
Yes.
You could say he was on the force for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
which isn't all that long. When do we suddenly become a veteran?
Oh gosh, who knows? I would think that you become a veteran after you leave the job.
Yeah.
But that's
no. But
that's
we do
not,
say he's yeah, a 26-year right. veteran of the police force.
Right. I think after it's an appreciable amount of time.
Let's go next to Ned from Queens. Hi, you're on the air. Ned, are you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's Ed, but I was calling about an expression that I hear news anchors use all the time when they say, you know, we will return momentarily. Mm. And I always thought that momentarily meant for a moment, and mm-hmm. I think they use it to mean in a moment. Could you clarify
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I think usage has changed on that. People used to always complain about momentarily to mean soon rather than for a moment. In other words, in a moment rather than for a moment. But I think usage has changed, and now they're both accepted, if I'm not mistaken. I'm just checking my dictionary here. This is another example of what I was talking about, how
right.
if enough people adopt a usage, that becomes the usage.
Becomes the norm.
Right.
Yeah, it's true. It happens in a lot of other languages, too. So
right. Actually, here's a usage note in American Heritage about momentarily. It's widely used to mean in a moment, as in
wow.
he'll be with you momentarily.
But they say it's widely used, which is not the same
right.
thing as saying it means that.
Right. They go on to say many critics hold that the adverb should be reserved for the sense for a moment.
Right.
And the extended usage is unacceptable to a little over half of American Heritage's usage panel. However, there is a new dictionary out. There's a new fifth edition, which I haven't received yet, but I can't wait to look up some of these things in there and see if it's advanced in the last 10 years. Hmm. I wouldn't be surprised.
Thank you for calling us.
Very interesting, and thanks for your help.
Mm-hmm.
We have some other people writing in. Jennifer Kate from Manhattan wants you to know that euphemize is correct. She looked it up in the 11th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. Others have pointed out that another death phrase is sleeping with the fishes.
Oh, yeah. Well, that one has a sinister connotation, doesn't it? Doesn't it sort of mean that you've had cement booties
yeah,
attached
that's a mob
and you've been
connected thing?
Yeah, right. You've ratted somebody out and you've paid the price.
Now we have very little time, but this caller George is asking about something that we are often asked about. So George, can you make it? I know whenever I say, "Can you make it quick?" people slow down, but can you try to make it as quick as possible?
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just about strange little formations of speech that get into language very quickly, and people seem to imitate each other. And
give us the example, George.
Saying it. Well, like, the thing is that.
Oh, the double is.
Yeah.
It's called a double copula. Yeah, that's when you...
President Obama uses this.
That happens because people start a sentence with the thing is, and then they go on to say, is da-da-da-da-da. Because they forget they've already used a verb.
Another thing George wanted to talk about was people starting off sentences with so. I hear that mm-hmm. a lot from guests. Mm-hmm. It's happening more
right.
and more, especially people in the sciences.
Right. Nothing wrong with it. It's a conjunction in that case. And it's not wrong to start a sentence with a conjunction, maybe a little monotonous.
It's just a way of throwing in a transition, isn't it?
Right. A little bridge.
You will be back with us on the 21st.
Yes.
And I look forward to that. Meanwhile, if you want to ask Pat a question, you can email her directly at mailbox@grammophobia.com. And you can click on Pat's blog at grammophobia.com to see a selection of language questions that have come in from WNYC listeners, some of the things that have inspired you on this show in the past. So I look forward to seeing you. And I'm sorry to all of you who were not able to get on the air. Go right now to grammophobia.com.